producers.
So when Chase Cuts actually started, did they launch it pretty big? Did you have some large client stations already ready to roll? Or did it kind of slowly inch its way up a hill and then kind of get to a peak?
It launched really big. And like I was saying, that's the advantage of being with Clear Channel. They have all these stations and can have all this clout. So basically, the whole thing was really a product of them trying to figure out a way to pay me. Because oddly enough, it was like this when John Frost left K-Rock and went to Premiere to start mm-hmm. Frostbites, it created this panic at K-Rock. And they started talking to me, and I was kind of interested in it being like such a cool station for one thing.
Yeah.
And coming from a rock background myself, it was like, oh, I was dying to get back to rock. So I went out and talked to them, and fortunately, you know, Clear Channel being like they are, you know, not very attentive to contracts and stuff, they'd let mine expire, and so they had this big war between CBS and Clear Channel. So the result of that was I ended up staying with Clear Channel, but they ended up, you know, having to figure out, you know, some way, how are we going to pay this guy this much, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, they had to figure out, and basically what they came up with was like, oh, well, maybe we ram this custom, you know, he's doing all this stuff for all these CHRs anyway, so let's create a service over with Premier. We'll ram that down their throat, and I think they had to. This is like Sean Compton, who's now up at Tribune Broadcasting, actually, WGN. TV,
mm-hmm.
which is another connection. That's the TV, one of the TV stations I voice. But
it's good to know people, right?
Yeah, it's good to know people. You go way back with these people. But where was I in this whole?
So basically, Clear Channel was shoving it down people's throats and finding a way to pay you.
So they. That's kind of the way that's the way it evolved. That's the way the idea evolved. Sean Compton kind of rammed it down Premier's throat, who was like, we don't really want to do it, but okay. So, but immediately they, because I mean, Sean had, lined up all the stations because, you know, stations don't mind giving up barter so much if they have it. But man, they hate writing a check.
Yeah.
So it's like, it was not that hard of a sell, you know. So,
you had mentioned that you were already doing so much of this stuff for all the CH or a bunch of CHRs. What exactly were you doing at the time pre Chase Cuts?
Well, I had sort of become the go-to CHR guy, and we were doing all these. So whenever there was a big startup, I'd do the startup package. Whenever there was a group contest, I'd do the group contest, you know? So I was doing all this sort of corporate-level stuff,
mm-hmm.
Knowing that because these guys like Tom Owens were now at the corporate level, Sean Compton being another one, they were now at the corporate level going, oh, hey, what's this? We got this project coming up. Hey, maybe Eric could do this, you know? It's like, and you know, I enjoy doing a lot of different stuff. I kind of missed having a news talk going on in a lot of ways because it's a whole different, you know, way of using your brain as opposed to CHR. It's like the flip side. It was a good mix for me in Tampa doing CHR and news talk. But as soon as Chase Cuts came along, I became... I kind of left those to my assistants, Nick Daly at the time and Phil Azoon, who's still at WFLA, and then started doing Chase Cuts full time. And, you know, like I was saying, it got enough initial acceptance that Premier was like, wow, this is great.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they found it really easy to sell. And so there was never a struggle. They were just ended up being very happy. And so they totally leave me alone and let me do my thing.
When you had started that, so you said previous you were already kind of doing some stuff. How long before Chase Cuts officially launched? Actually, when did Chase Cuts officially launch?
I think it might have been in 04. Might have been just in January of 04. It seems like that was the right That was when it's launched.
Okay. What were you already producing tons of effects and beats and you know?
Yeah, because see, the thing was, I had to do when you're producing on the corporate level, it the old school you know, production library thing becomes hard to deal with, because you got to produce for all these markets. You got to do these startups where they don't have any packages.
Yeah.
So I was having to do stuff on the fly, which is still, you know, the way I kind of do stuff is kind of do it on the fly and get really bogged down in it. But that's what I ended up doing, is that's how I kind of got into sound design, just by necessity. I had to figure out how to do it, because I had to do all this stuff that had no budget for sound design and had to be corporate-wide or whatever. So that, you know, kind of got me into it initially. And by the time Chase Cuts rolled along, I had kind of this library going of Clear Channel only stuff.
Before that, were you putting it up on the imaging.clearchannel.com, the Clear Channel imaging site?
There was a bunch. There was a big pile of sound design up there at some point.
And so we're going to kind of use this to transition into the technical side of things. But we'll start kind of there. I don't know what over the years you may have used lots of different tools, but for instance, when you're creating the beds that are just so unique to Chase Cuts, you know, were you doing them more organically? Did you have some digital tools that you were using to create these beds and you know, stage your beats?
You mean currently?
Well, I'm actually kind of curious maybe how you started making them and then what you kind of do currently, how it evolved.
Well, it was much more low-tech in the beginning. It's like I'm always adding new stuff and really always keep looking out for new people. I mean, I'm getting a lot of stuff from I'm doing less and less beds myself because they do take a long time. It's one of the things I really enjoy,
yeah,
music stuff. I'm doing less of them because I'm getting, I have this French guy named Julian Carras. His name, I'm not sure even how I pronounce it. We're just email acquaintances, and he does these killer, you know, really fat, beats and beds and stuff. This other guy, Max Rebo in LA, does some nice, juicy, hip hoppy kind of stuff. And between, you know, those two guys and Nick Daly and me and, you know, that's pretty much all it is as far as beds go, at least at the moment. Yeah. I'm pretty happy with the mix.
Yeah. I think most people, nobody ever has any of the bag to say about Chase Cuts. So the reason I bring that up a little bit is because if there's one thing I've always thought, and I think people think, is there's just something about the way your stuff is produced. It just has this extra punch. There's just always, you know, the hits have lots of depth. I'm sure layering is involved, but there's just always this just full punch that comes with the beats in your beds, the punches in your hits, your wipes, everything. And I'm just curious if there's a trick you use, if there's something in the way you master, you know, how is that happening?
I think it's just kind of being anal about everything, every, you know, single step. I've just always had this sort of almost like over-aggressive mentality across the board. Even when I played guitar in a band, I'd play so hard that every single night I would break strings. Like by the fourth set, I would break a string. So it's like I had to put a new set of strings on every night. So it's like everything to me is like aggressive. So it's like I'm always striving to make everything, you know, punched a little bit more and just be. And I have kind of imparted that to Nick Daly too, and he's anal like that when it comes to audio. Mm-hmm. I think he's even more anal about it than I am.
I think he mentioned that to me actually.
Oh yeah, we're such geeks.
Yeah, I mean, he mentioned are anal, but I think he might have actually mentioned he's as anal or more anal than you.
Yeah, he's totally anal.
I think we might have used the word anal too many times in this episode.
Yep, anal. He's actually across town. It's like, I think we're probably going to get together this weekend and do something. Actually, a couple weekends ago, we went out to the range and shot some weapons and actually recorded the audio too.
Really?
For you know, sound design and stuff.
What kind of mic did you use to record that audio?
Well, that audio I just recorded right to my Zoom because I didn't want to drag in a, you know, major setup or anything.
Yeah.
But I do have a stereo. I have a stereo AKG that can run Phantom Power off a battery, which is really nice. I find it's a really nice full sound for taking it out in the field, though. If the mm-hmm. if the Zoom mic, I got the H4, I think it is. But it's a nice little box. It's got a nice sound to the mic. So, I mean, I've been very impressed with just what you get right off the mic. I was amazed that it captured the gunshots up close. I had to turn the gain way down.
Yeah.
But I was amazed it didn't distort anyway. I mean, usually cheap really? Mics would just fritz out with that yeah. kind of, signal.
Yeah, it seems like you can peak them out way too easy.
Yeah.
Continuing with the tech theme here, I'm gonna go over these listener questions here. I know that Grant, I believe, is one of our New Zealand listeners. He's curious about all your processing, but let's also start your favorite mic to use on voice. He may not have known, like I didn't know, that you're not a huge voice guy. I mean, you're not into it. You don't like it. But I'm sure you're well aware of what you like sounds good on a voice.
Well, you know, it seems like you can't go wrong with the old 416 shotgun.
Yeah.
A lot of people are using those. I'm speaking into one right now.
Nice. I'm not, but I have one at the home studio.
I'm open to anything. I kind of like, I bought this, what is it? I had to send it back because it was crackly. It's a Massey. It's like this. It's like a $900 tube mic,
mm-hmm.
and I wanted something that's a little more open to be able to do, sung vocals and sound a little more open, like a Neumann or something.
Yeah.
Rather than you get kind of a closed in sound from the shotgun, I think. But mm-hmm. that's why it makes it a good voiceover mic. I mean, the shotgun is very clean and neutral. So this Sennheiser 416 shotgun is still a great, just one of the best all around vocal mics for just across the board.
I'd agree with you. I think also, I think a lot of people are familiar with it by now, but those who aren't, it's very forgiving of your room. So if you haven't spent a ton of money treating your room or whatever you're speaking in, the 416, those shotgun type mics also are pretty forgiving.
Yeah, absolutely. And you need that for most home studios, because this is one of the things I was kind of never got around to, because I started meandering when we were talking about the home studio thing. You know, the thing you don't think about is when you're, think about your CD player and your monitors and think about speakers and stuff like that. But you don't think about how live your room is.
Yeah.
And Nick is going through that right now, and he designed his room, and he's got Oralex and stuff all over the place, and the room is still live. It's just like this maddening slapback that's just driving him crazy.
Yeah. It's crazy, and it's so true. And for instance, when they build up these, like I'm sitting in a multi-$100,000 studio at Citadel Dallas,
Mm-hmm.
They spent more on the treating of the room. I mean, I've got floating floors, floating ceilings. The walls are all 6 inches deep with everything. They spent more on the treatment of the room than they did on all the equipment. And you can do the same thing at your home studio if you don't watch out.
Wow.
You know?
Yeah, you can. Clear Channel would never do that. they would wait till they would construct everything so cheaply that you start getting the people down the hall are bitching for you to turn stuff down. And people upstairs are bitching. You can't even listen loud because it bleeds.
Yeah, that this where I am was built a few years ago, and they still had lots of money, and it was ABC. So,
but that's the thing about the home studio thing. That's the thing you really got to think about is getting some stuff up in your room, or else running a finding a closet that has just the right amount of deadness. It doesn't sound like a coffin.
Mm-hmm.
I had some pretty good luck when I was constructing this studio, a year of hell, I might add. I mean, yeah. I was trying to work in the next room. I don't know how I survived it. I had like, 1 year old kids, barely, getting 2-3 hours of sleep a night, and and jackhammering in the room next to where I was trying to work, you know. Oh, it was brutal. But at that time, I was doing some, I did voiceover. I had to do this daily stuff for Glenn Beck. And this when he had a CNN TV show, I was doing this thing on CNN or on Headline News. And I had to do these long scripts in the closet in there. Mm-hmm. But it sounded pretty good. So, you know, I after I had gotten some pillows deranged in the right spots, I got a pretty good vocal booth sound out of that closet. But it's almost like any bedroom you get into, you're going to have this nasty drywall slapback.
Yeah.
So that's like the first thing you got to think about instead of the last thing you think about.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing for people to know is the corners are going to be your biggest enemies. Corners are absolutely awful for slapback.
But that is a good reason why it's good to have a nice a mic like the, you know, spend the money if you're doing serious voiceover stuff.
Yeah.
You know, go ahead and spend the money on something like the shotgun, because it's not going to pick up the fans of your computers like some of the, you know, bigger Tubi mics can do, or the cheap mics.
Yeah, I wanted to point out real quick, you sent me, you know, I will have mentioned this in the intro, but also you sent me so much stuff, which everybody's going to love. A lot of Beck stuff, though. So we were just talking about your stuff on Beck, and that's posted on my website for people to check out. Want to make sure they knew that.
I didn't send any of the Beck audio. That was just the video stuff, I think.
Yeah, a lot of video. I think you did. Didn't you send me one piece? It was a bit of some sort. I'm actually looking right now. I could be incorrect, but...
I sent the 911 thing was a kind of a Beck thing.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I listened to that. You know what? I'll make a note. I mean, I'll just tell people we're talking. I don't want to talk on the inside here, but the 911, the September 11th montage you did, which was for Beck, is posted. And I had not heard that before today. And I was actually, you know, I lived out east when that happened. And it's just, you know, it's pretty crazy.
Yeah, I know. It'll stop you.
Yes. It'll set you back.
I can't listen to it.
I can imagine why you can't listen to it.
It's brutal, man.
I can't imagine producing that.
It haunts me. I tell you what, there's this part, because I uncovered all this obscure audio, like somebody talking on a cell phone in the stairwell, and like cops on the, or the firemen calling out to people who aren't answering anymore. And that's the stuff that really haunted me. And like I got, it was like one of those producer's luck things where I just had the right, found the right little elements that lined up with it and made it really haunting.
Do you know where you found a lot of that actuality audio?
I was just searching the web.
Just on the web, really. Yeah. Like I know one that really stood out to me was the lady leaving a phone message for her husband, basically saying "I love you," and then I'm pretty confident.
Yeah,
she
I think
died.
I found that on the web, but I did get a lot from. See, it was that became like a Clear Channel, another Clear Channel chain wide 911 anniversary piece as well.
Mm.
And so I may have to change it a little bit for that or something. But there was all this Clear Channel, all the radio station stuff came from various Clear Channel stations. I think I looked on the Clear Channel site for whatever I could collect from Z100. And
yeah, you had Elvis. That one's pretty famous. I've heard that bit that you used on a lot of montages.
Yeah. I found it interesting that the people one little bit that only a little bit made it in there, but when I was looking for this thing, I found the mix out of it. It was just these girls reacting to it. And it's like these girls in a room, I don't know whether they were shooting video of themselves or something. And they saw the second plane hit.
Mm-hmm.
And their reaction was just like, oh, wow. Just brings you right back.
So for the people that have maybe paused and gone to check that out, because it is posted, how long did something like that take you to make, just out of curiosity? You know, from gathering all the audio, putting it together, finding the elements, everything.
God, it took me forever. I can't even remember. It probably took me probably at least like 2 or 3 days, I would imagine, from the, you know, starting to gather, you know, elements to actually having a final mix. That's probably one of those things. Well, you know, it may have been one of those things where I spent like 24 hours solid on it or something. I don't know. Where I just, you know, pulled an all-nighter and then went to bed. I don't know. I don't remember.
Crazy.
I remember it being really, it was hard. It was really hard on me. I was just like, because it was too fresh, you know.
Yeah. So to go back a little bit here into the technical side of things, people, I get, I don't know how many questions I get asking about your plugins, and we already know you're a Pro Tools user. I imagine you're on 8.0.4, whatever the latest is.
Yeah, I think I finally went to 8.04.
As far as plugins, I imagine you're the kind of guy that has tons of them. But do you have any favorites, for instance, favorite EQs that you like to use?
Yeah, I still am. You know, I'm a fan of a couple of, I mean, I actually, you know, I'm kind of going back to analog days. It's like I realized that every single EQ has its own unique character.
Yeah.
It's like I like having a bunch of them. It's like my kind of go-to EQ for surgical, you know, really surgical, a very precise EQ is the Oxford, the Sonox Oxford bundle.
I think Nick brought that up. I think multiple people did, but I think Nick brought that up too.
I love that. So they're expensive. And then, of course, I think it's Pro Tools only, but I've always used the Focusrite bundle. Mm. That was the first good EQ I think I've ever gotten my hands on.
Yeah.
Because I've never, the first time I ever touched a Pro Tools, I immediately fell in love with this Focusrite EQ because it actually did something, you know. Mm-hmm. I was used to like this horrible cheap EQ that didn't really work very well.
What about Waves? Are you a Waves user?
I've had the gold bundle forever, so it's like I do, you know, actually now that I've upgraded, I had to upgrade my Waves recently. So now that I've upgraded the Waves, I found there's some stuff in there that I kind of like. There's a couple of EQs in the bundle I have. I think it's Platinum now. Mm-hmm. That are pretty pleasing to the voice. It has that, you know, that high end that doesn't immediately get horribly, you know, brittle.
Yeah, like kind of crunchy and raspy.
Like the Puig, I think it's called Puig Tech something or other. It's that that producer guy, that rock producer, Jack Joseph Puig.
Yeah.
But he's got a bunch of stuff, the SSL-based stuff that's really nice, but I still do like the, you know, we were talking about punchiness and stuff.
Yeah.
I still, you know, I've for years, I used the C1 and the L1 on my master.
Okay. Together?
Yeah. C1 followed by the L1, followed by the PAS, so I could see where my levels were.
Mm-hmm.
But I find I'm always constantly moving the level of my master up and down to get the right level into the master chain. It's like I find that, you know, it's just so easy to get, you know, to get overly squashed. You want to be in the pocket where they're just barely working. But recently, I find that the Oxford bundle is, I think it's punchier and cleaner than the Wave stuff.
So you put the Oxford compressor on the master?
Yeah, well, generally, you know, a lot of times I will bypass the compressor and not use it and just put the master on there, just tickling the master so I can get to up around zero.
Okay.
But I don't want to squash it down because then it gets, you know, it gets squashed on the air and it's just, it could get ugly.
I know personally for me, it's always been my biggest problem. I mean, I have lots of problems, but this one is I overcompress, and I probably compress the master too much. I'm always afraid of what the station compression is going to do to the sound of my final product.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I end up losing probably a lot more dynamic range than I should. And I don't know. Then I hear stuff that you do, and I can see the audio. I can see that you're keeping your dynamic range intact, but it still sounds so big. So I know it can be frustrating for me, and I know it's frustrating for others as well. So.
It's just, and it's frustrating for me too because I ride the slider. In fact, I have this PreSonus, this little single slider thing.
Yeah.
And generally, I like to have that on my reflecting my master, so I can just make these tiny adjustments as I watch the C1 or whatever is first in the chain.
Yeah.
To go to get it to back it off to where it's not, you know, not I'm not seeing the yellow happen. It's for me, the C1L1, it would sound really, really good if it was in just the right pocket.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, so if you were being consistent in the levels you put in and your plugins were consistent, I think, you know, a lot of times what people have a lot too much level happening. And so they're going from plugin to plugin on tracks with too much level between the plugins. So there's distortion building up and everything gets nasty and squashy. And so there's no more room in the mix. But I'm kind of liking this Oxford chain now, because the compressor, I can get a very kind of transparent compressor with just a little tiny bit of fullness. And then the limiter afterwards is very, very clean without that L1 kind of a crunch that you get when you bring it down too far. And but again, I have this hyper sense of when it's getting crunchy to my ears. So I'm constantly reaching over with my index finger to move the slider just slightly one way or the other while watching for the threshold to not go anymore, you know?
Yeah, I don't want to spend too much time on this, but I got another one. On your vocal chain, we've been talking a little more on mastering, but how do you process vocals when you get them? I'm sure every voice is different and all that, but do you bus everything through some sort of aux and have some sort of EQ, compressor, limiter, gate on everything? Or?
Well, it depends on what I'm doing, but usually I don't bus everything unless I'm doing background vocals, kind of sung vocals generally.
Yeah.
Or shouted something with a crowd.
Okay.
Then I have a template, or actually, instead of using templates anymore, I'm starting from scratch and kind of importing tracks. But my that template would include 12 mono tracks bus to an aux.
Yeah.
And then that aux would have an EQ, a compressor, and maybe a verb on it or something.
Okay.
Or maybe a little bit of, say, chorusy, flangey stuff. I'm getting, there's a lot of producers currently in pop and hip hop who are using these very subtle kind of flangey effects on background vocals and lead vocals. Sometimes that can work if it's just barely there.
Yeah.
That would be the when I bust stuff. Then you can pan those. You can pan those mono tracks all around and get this nice spacious crowdy kind of thing. So I have a template that has all the tracks, you know, ready to go, bust to the right bus with an aux with the right plugins on it, all panned, you know, starting like super wide and just kind of getting consistently narrower, so you kind of fill the whole spectrum. So that's kind of what I use for background vocals, or like stacked background vocals or shouted crowd things.
Yeah.
It really helps to bus them in that case. But, you know, I find in Pro Tools for just the VO part.
Yeah.
I've gotten, you know, simpler and simpler over the years, really. It always depends on the voice, of course, but.
Let's just talk about your voice when you have stuff in chase cuts, where it's you doing a Kiss FM or something.
Uh-huh.
What do you do to get that sort of signature-y sound you have?
Well, I don't really have a signature sound. I mean, for me, I'm always grasping for the signature sound, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I don't like using my voice. I'm trying to get to, you know, a less processy sound, and I find that, you know, for me, the five sends, the five inserts in Pro Tools is plenty for your average voiceover, you know, piece.
Sure.
Generally, I'll have an EQ on there just in case it needs some modifications. I mean, it's pretty rare you get something that's perfect, you know, in the mix.
Yeah.
I just used to whack off the bottom of Corley, and he would just sound so good. You know, whack him off about 100, and it just fits in the mix so well. Mm-hmm. If you whack off the – and by the way, and someone is asking, I say, just put the high-pass filter at 100. I said, great. well, what's a high pass filter? Well, that's the HPF that you see on your EQ, and that basically lets the highs pass while cutting off the lows at the designated frequency.
Yeah.
So it's like if you cut Corley off at 100, he's still in the mix. He sounds totally full, but his low end isn't bogging down the music mix. And that's how you, that's one way you get your mixes cleaner and punchier, is to worry about where things sit in the mix and not have too much going on at any frequency level. And that's the same thing applies to sound design. If you're making a hit, the worst thing you can do is try to make it big by putting big stuff in there. It's like you make it big by layering a lot of small stuff, really. And each thing has its own designated frequency range. So you end up in a sound design, you know, session for a lot of, for say, hits or something. You might have a lot of tracks with various EQs on them that, that have high-pass filters and low-pass filters. So you have your, the ability to cut off the, you know, determine what slice of frequency goes through, and you just dedicate each, you know, sound to a slice of frequency, instead of letting them bleed over, and you end up with a much tighter sound.
Hmm. This is lending the, or begging the question of counter EQing. Do you find yourself doing a lot of that to get, for instance, a VO, more on that side of things, to get that to sit in the mix better? So not just chopping off 100 and below, but also counter EQing the stuff around him?
Yeah, I have at times. It's like my voice. My voice is not, it's not Corley, so it doesn't knock crap out of the way.
Yeah.
Which, you know, we all have that problem if we have a normal sounding voice, you know.
Yeah.
So a lot of times, yeah, I'll like, I'll knock the bed down while I'm talking, not the, knock the bed down in the, somewhere in the mid range to let me, you know, float above it a little more.
Yeah.
With a voice like Corley, it's just effortless. And I find that with female voices, it's sometimes a little more effortless. But for me, it's like my voice isn't distinctive enough or gritty enough or something to get over stuff without some degree of EQ, you know, some degree of processing. And to me, I like my voice, if I'm using it, I like to put it in flat and then manipulate it depending on what it needs to sound like in the context of the promo. So my voice kind of just goes in there flat, goes into Pro Tools flat, and then might get a plug-in chain with an EQ, a compressor, and you know, maybe something else. But lately I'm kind of prone to, you know, I'm just using various EQs and speaker sounds and distortions to create different textures, because I'm just tired of all the radio textures, you know?
Yeah.
I'm just tired of everything.
I had a friend turn me on, actually Dan in, at PLJ turned me on to the speakerphone plugin.
Oh, yeah. I love speakerphone.
Yeah, I've been using it for the last few months now. I don't understand how you can have an EQ and it can take away frequencies and enhance frequencies and do everything. But then you have another EQ, or I guess what I'm trying to say is it's so weird to me how a certain EQ or plugin can just get so many new sounds that other EQs can't do. You know what I mean?
It just shows you the need for real EQs. I mean, that the EQ everybody seems to have, the Renaissance, or I mean, you know, the Waves EQs, they're not good EQs. I mean, the Renaissance has it's okay and it has its place, but it's not a precise, you know, EQ, and it gets real crunchy. So, which makes it really good for that Dave Campbell crunch VO chain, by the way. Mm-hmm. I found that was like a necessary part. If you want to get that really crunchy nastiness, it really takes the Renaissance EQ. But then you go up the ladder to all the way up to the Oxford. It's like, oh, this is, you know, you get some nice people, like, you know, you're for me, finding that it's finding the mid frequency that punches out. So I'll create a boost in the mid range, and then I'll roll that around a little bit as I'm playing to find out what punches it above the bed or whatever it needs to get over.
Yeah.
And maybe give it a little juice in that range. But I find for my voice, that 400 to 500 range seems like it gives it that magical weird low mid filtery sound.
Yeah.
Without
you punch
sounding
it there, or you pass, or you drop out below that.
Yeah, and drop out below that, yeah. But have a little hump there happening between 400 and 500 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And it often like just pops it out just really nicely because there's not a lot happening in that frequency range in general. So it tends to get out.
That doesn't you know what, actually that's good. I could sit here and talk about this stuff forever. So
yeah,
I want to get into the sort of a future talk a little bit. So I'm just gonna stop myself.
I would add one thing about EQ in general because I've heard people. God, I remember Anne DeWig, who's a great producer. I mean, now she just does VO stuff.
Yeah,
but she's a really good producer. She went to they used to send these producers to hang with me for a while. And there was a couple of years where they'd send these kind of promising young producers to hang with me in Tampa and kind of soak up something.
Mm-hmm.
And she came over and she was telling me, well, the guy who's kind of my production boss in Denver at the time.
Yeah,
says,
she was at BPI, I believe, right?
Yeah, he says, you shouldn't use EQ or compression. It's like, what?
Hmm.
It's like, I don't know how I'd live with EQ and compression. However, I do understand that it's overused stuff, and in the wrong hands, it can be very dangerous, but it really is important to get a handle on EQ and compression if you want your stuff to be tweaked. And EQ is basically, when it comes down to the basics, it's all about, trimming up the audio in terms of frequency so it fits together better. And that's how you get better mixes. I instantly got better mixes in the world of digital when you could always trim out all the junk that was happening on the other tracks, you know? Because there's always a lot of junk going on. So you can really, clean things up to a great extent. And then if you talk about really carving out these frequency ranges in EQ, that's how you get your stuff to fit together. And then being very anal about how you process the master and just finding the right pocket for whatever processors you're using. Because it seems like there's a sweet spot, you know, in that thing. So there's a sweet spot for the Oxford chain, there's a sweet spot for the Waves chain, and it's like I'm having since I got this new system, I'm struggling a little bit to find the sweet spot in my new system where the level is, where the levels on the track really agree with the levels on the master and so forth and so on, because you know, sometimes I used to had this sweet spot for many years where I felt really confident, and now it's kind of, I've rocked the boat with this new system. So, but that's the EQ basics. It's like, so EQ and compression are important, but man, you got to really know how to use them.
Yeah.
And use them, smartly.
Yeah. That's kind of what I was saying. I was probably an overuser. I've been backing myself off over the last couple few years and within my templates. But real quick, also, as I think of another thing, as far as mastering, have you used the L3 multi-maximizer?
I've been wanting to because I now have that. I just recently, when the upgrade came along, and I had that for the first time. So I'm going to try that at some point. But that's when I start getting scared by putting any kind of EQ on the masters. I know a lot of guys do it. I know Jeff Thomas likes to put an EQ on his master.
Yeah. I use the L3, and I have a setting on there. And I used to put an L1. Or a C4, I forget, a long time ago. And I felt like when I went to the L3, it was taking myself back a bit. I wasn't over compressing my mixes. And I did like the EQ on the master.
Yeah. You know, I was trying the C4 thing for a while, and I found that it's like, I would like it at the time, and then I'd listen back later and go, ooh.
Yeah.
That's kind of scared me off.
Like there was muddiness you weren't hearing at the time, and then later on you're like, wow, that is not good.
Or there was brittleness that you thought was really clean at the time.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, that's one of those things where it really does pay when your ears are fried and you're mixing something for a long time to walk away and come back, because immediately you might go, oh crap, you know, it's like, that's one thing that not conducive in radio. It's like you're doing this mass unit production and hurrying up and getting stuff on the air. Yeah. A lot of times you hear it on the air and then go, oh, crap, man, the mix is totally off.
Well, I imagine this will be basically at least a part three. I wanted to take just a little bit of time here. And you had already brought some of these things up in the past here in this interview. But I want to talk about the future of radio and what you kind of talked about as things already changing. And maybe in your mind, they got worse or bad or not good in even the middle to late 90s. But, you know, from where you started to where things have gone, what have you seen happen to our world, you know, the imaging production world?
Well, it's crazy. You know, it's strange to think about it because I have lived through this kind of momentous time where radio kind of grew into this gigantic monster, mm-hmm. and now is starting to shrink with all the other sort of media. All this, you know, quote unquote traditional media are kind of getting panicky at the moment because of all the slices that everything's divvied up into now. It's just there are smaller slices of pie nowadays in media in general, and radios and TV and everything else. They're going to have to deal with it and figure out how to move on. And I just don't know. I'm just not encouraged by radio's, you know, attempt to deal with it by basically doing what they always do and cut costs.
Yeah.
So it's like trying to pull the wool over the listener's eyes. It's like the listener has gotten, if you're talking about young listeners, they've gotten too savvy to do that. You can't pull the wool over their eyes anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be cynical like them. So it's like, I think radio needs to, you know, hopefully there'll be an opportunity for, you know, some rebels to come along and grab some chunks of stations and do something interesting. But because it's all, you know, radio is just now a portion of this whole brand that includes, you know, the website and
yeah.
the stream you hear on iHeartRadio or whatever. So, you know, radio's still going to be around, but I'm afraid that they're just going to look at it as this junk medium that, you know, in terms of the money people, just they need to, we need to put it on a little short budget leash and see if we can find a pocket where it doesn't cost us too much money, you know.
Do you think that the way that things have gone, because you definitely have been in it from its huge glory days to then the kind of going down the hill, are going to have a better effect, a worse effect, the same effect on a service like Chase Cuts or other services that are out there versus your local producers?
Well, it's changing for everybody, you know. It's like the numbers change on the, you know, even if you get more, like even a station's lay people off, there's sort of a, you know, theoretical need for more production coming from somewhere.
Yeah.
But really they're lessening the total of imaging that goes on, you know, so that's changing. I don't know where that's totally going.
Have you seen any negative effects on Chase Cuts since it started to today?
It's really been very solid in terms of its just you know, performance. But the revenue goes up and down depending on ad rates, just okay. like. Yeah. The whole radio business, it's like amazing how much this has fluctuated just because of the economy. You can have the same amount of stations, the same AQH and everything else, but you'll have significantly less revenue because of the, I don't know, nebulous world of ad rates and how they're figured and sold yeah. and so forth.
Yeah.
So that becomes, I'm glad I'm not, you know, too involved in that world. I'm lucky. I have an agent to deal with the whole premiere end of things, and mm-hmm. So I have little human contact, which is good and bad, I guess.
Do you like that? You know, you've been working out of your home studio for quite a while, and you probably do a lot of your communication with people, like maybe me or a client station guy or the little producer. Via email and whatnot. Do you like that, or do you think that's a bad thing for you as a producer?
Well, you know, it's It's good and bad. It's kind of like everything these days. It's like digital audio. It's like technology. It's good and it's bad, you know?
Yeah.
It isn't one or the other. It's like, I can, there are good things about that, but I do feel isolated, you know? So it's good to have some, you know, actual face-to-face human contact every now and then. Good to have some phone contact. Mm-hmm. Where you actually have a conversation with somebody. Otherwise, I'm just sort of in this multi, you know, I'm trying to get myself out of this full-time multitasking mode where email comes in needing something, stop everything, do what email says, wonder where you were, you know. I need a dose of Dave Fox organization. That guy, he has the, I mean, he's like Mr. Organization. He has the skills so down that I'm just so jealous of his, you know, his systems.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried to implement some of those, some of his ideas, but I just find myself always struggling to, you know, stay organized.
Do you have any tricks that you've learned, especially for those that have kids and other people, you know, affecting their lives immediately, that you've learned to kind of manage your time and to make sure you're putting time aside for family and not working 15 hours, 16 hours a day?
I don't, but man, I wish I would be welcome to, if anybody would give some to me because I need them. It's like I do have that tendency to just lock myself in the studio and just, because I'm a very lucky dude because I'm doing something that I love, playing with knobs and audio and stuff, making mm-hmm. noise, playing with music, you know, doing recording. I love recording stuff. And so, you know, I'm just geek out on it. And so I'd be doing, you know, whether I'm working or not working, it's likely I may be sitting in front of one of these computers.
Yeah.
So it's hard to make that. Once you have it right there full time, I really have a hard time making the distinction. So it's like after the kids go to bed, I'm generally back in here to try to wrap up the, you know, day's worth of stuff and get everything kind of organized and wrap up whatever voiceover may have come in and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I find that I'm still in here a lot, except it's just, you know, a couple hours here, a couple hours there, a couple hours here, 3 hours here. So I'm not getting those, you know, 8 hour bursts of really intense production that I used to be able to get, like, say, late night in the Clear Channel building.
Two more kind of main things here, but we're, you know, as we come to a close here, I wanted to discuss PPM real quick, what your thoughts are on what PPM has done to the imaging world, the future of radio or radio imaging based on PPM, because I know that Chase Cuts has put a lot of focus on, you know, PPM friendly elements and that kind of thing.
Well, I am, you know, talking to the, you know, some of the key people in the format, and it still seems to me like the jury's out on what it all means. You know, it's like I've seen a lot of knee jerking and so forth, and of course, everything has gotten a lot shorter, and there's a sort of panic about doing anything that would stop the music,
mm-hmm.
you know. But I think what it's all going to boil down to, and I saw some research recently that kind of reinforced this. It's like they did some research, and it's like it determined that like people like stuff that's good, and they don't like stuff that's not good. You know, it's like, well, duh.
Right, they spent $312,000 to learn that.
But there's the rub, because you don't know that line between something that is, I think somebody put it, you know, basically play the say something quickly about a current pop culture item and then play a song. That was their gist of what they want CHR radio to be. Say something clever and funny about a current thing and then play a song. And so the question is, what's clever and what's stupid? Because that's where the gray area is, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And can you be clever enough, quickly enough? That's hard to do.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, by necessity, I think a lot of stuff has to get simple. and sort of elegant. And, you know, that's why we're trying to use a lot of, you know, trying to use a lot of listener audio and trying to use some natural listener audio for a change. That's why I like the sound of stations that are, they may have an anchor voice, but then they're using a lot of listeners to, like, the listener becomes the anchor voice, you know, doing the frequency and call letters a lot.
Do you have any stations that you've paid attention to recently that you think are doing a really great job?
You know, I haven't really listened to enough current radio to make a judgment, really.
Okay.
You know, I'm kind of always watching TV to determine what I want stuff to sound and feel like.
Yeah.
You know, I like stuff like there's some amazing production stuff on stuff like Science Channel. Some of these obscure cable channels, but I'm a G4. G4 has some amazing, cool little bits of imaging, branding production in between, little short things that are.
Well, I was gonna say I've thought of that in the past, and I imagine some of those stations to be like the older alt stations in radio, where it's like, all right, we've got our AC and our big rock that are dominating the market. Just let those alt kids do whatever the hell they want. And then so you just kind of let these people just get really creative and do what they want. And then suddenly you've got these great state. Like, I just imagine K-Rock having started like that, you know?
Yeah.
And then you got the G4s of the world that are like, we own like 30 cable channels, and G4 is not exactly what we care about, so just let them do whatever the hell they want, those nerds.
That's kind of what EBN was like. It's like we all have one of those in our past, but it's like radio doesn't allow that anymore, at least in the corporate world. So, there could easily be, I mean, I'm sure you could imagine, some station that could catch on in a viral way.
Mm-hmm.
If it was independent of one of these, it would have to be independent of one of the big companies.
Yeah.
And then you wonder about the business model. Well, can a station that's independent of a big company and not tied to other stations, can it even make money on the local level? Is it worth it? Can you maximize revenues from other stuff in order to make up for that?